information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge,
we care. It shows.
The law?
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Out of these troubled times, our fifth objective can emerge, a new world order. Welcome, my friends, to your source for news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. It's Media Monarchy, episode 84, July 18th, 2008. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host of MediaMonarchy.com and your webmaster. Tons to go over this week. Dollar doom, bank runs, Bush bribes, pizza and beer, top off five and SAIC, DHS, CNN, TSA, ACLU, watch lists. We got Chicago and Denver and the National Guard. And, of course, Obama, Charles Manson, and the Bohemian Grove. It's all here on episode 84. It's July 18th, 2008, and this is MediaMonarchy.com.
Is everybody here across the USA? Can everybody be sound like California? You see the weird in your back. Jesus doesn't answer. Everybody's gonna sue.
Welcome, my friends. That was the Jesus and Mary chain going back 20 some odd years. their cover of Surfing USA. Got to see them here in Portland last night, so I can definitely scratch off the list of bands I always wanted to see. They're, of course, like a lot of 80s, 90s alternative bands doing the Pixie-style reunion thing, so I was glad I went. However, there's more important things to deal with than Scottish fuzz rock. But let's take care of some business first. My name's James. This is Media Monarchy. It's episode 84, July 18th, 2008. Coming to you live, as always, every Friday morning at 10 Pacific time on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and Sunday nights at 7 Eastern time, revereradionetwork.com. You can, of course, hit me up, MySpace, Dig, YouTube, Yahoo, and I'm working on integrating, I think I've said this, maybe not, IM, Skype, and Twitter, again, all with Media Monarchy as your keyword. As I'm hitting the road here in a few days, I'm going to be on the road for a couple weeks, those might be good ways to get a hold of me. So MySpace and IM and Skype and Twitter and all that. And of course, iTunes, radioforall.net, and archive.org is where you can get the podcast. Radioforall.net, I think, is finally, for the most part, worked out all their kinks. However, the caveat is you may need to resubscribe to the feed. So it's all there up on the front page of MediaMonarchy.com. You can just re-hit the subscribe button. You can also just put in the MediaMonarchy.com feed into iTunes. And since it's the only MP3 I post up, it's the only thing that iTunes will pull down. So blah, blah, blah. I know I hate sometimes other shows I listen to and they painstakingly hold your hand while they talk about how to access the website and da-da-da. MediaMonarchy.com. That's all you need to know. Top of the page right now, my friends. Let's get into it. We're going down the rabbit hole this week. It's going to be ugly. Police informants, infiltrators, protests, and peace groups right now, today, Friday morning, blazing on page A1 in the Washington Post. Police spied on activists in Maryland. Undercover Maryland State Police officers conducted surveillance on war protesters and death penalty opponents, including some in Tacoma Park, for more than a year while Robert L. Ehrlich Jr. was governor, which, of course, documents released yesterday show. Detailed intelligence reports logged by at least two agents in the police department's Homeland Security and Intelligence Bureau reveal close monitoring of the movements as the Iraq War and capital punishment were heatedly debated in 2005 and 6. Organizational meetings, public forums, prison vigils, rallies outside the State House in Annapolis, and email group lists were infiltrated by police posing as peace activists and death penalty opponents. The surveillance continued even though the logs contained no reports of illegal activity and consistently indicated that the activists were not planning violent protests. Because that job is already taken by the provocateurs that are going to descend on both the conventions coming up. You can expect lots of Seattle WTO-like provocateur violence where the paid thugs break shit and then the other paid thugs, the federal thugs, the militarized police thugs, then get to turn loose and shoot women and children with rubber bullets and pepper balls and all that stuff. And we've covered some of the quote-unquote top-secret weapons they're going to be busting out at the conventions. So with that in mind, if we jump to Rocky Mountain News, this one's interesting and important because they mention and give a lot of, I believe, I haven't gone over it with a fine-tooth comb, but We Are Change Colorado gets prominent placement in this article. Police and protesters educate and gear up for convention. Dozens of protest groups are planning a full schedule of classes, concerts, marches, and other actions during the DNC, hoping to capture the world's attention and recruit new activists. They're both energized and organized, and most insist they're not looking for trouble. We are completely peaceful, said Rob Weiland, a 37-year-old courier from Denver and member of the group We Are Change Colorado.org. We follow the ideals of Gandhi. The organization will be videotaping other groups and police during the DNC, scheduled for August 25th through the 28th. And that article goes on, and of course, to detail some of the not-so-Gandhi-like groups, and of course, I've mentioned before, Recreate 68. And finally, if we hit up politicswest.com, FBI to descend on Denver for Dem event. hundreds, quote-unquote hundreds, of FBI agents will be in Denver during the Democratic National Convention, according to James Davis, the FBI special agent in charge of the Denver Field Division that oversees Colorado and Wyoming. And now I have a link over to denver.fbi.gov, and you can see that this guy was just hired about a month ago. The FBI is, quote, responsible for gathering intelligence on primarily terrorist activity, any possible terrorist activity with regard to the convention, and make sure we get that intelligence to our partner agencies so they can be prepared. This according to an interview on Colorado Public Radio on a show called Colorado Matters. I have the link to their page, as well as you can stream and listen to a little bit of an interview with Jim Davis, the new FBI special agent in charge. What exactly he's going to be in charge of, we shall see. Case in point, SAIC investigated for conflict of interest in Topoff 5. Now, the backstory, of course, Topoff 4 last fall here in Portland, Oregon. If you'll recall, we had the little scare incident where dogs detected bomb residue on some vehicles. SAIC was involved in that drill. That was Topoff 4. So right now, they're basically taking bids for Topoff 5. And so this is the Associated Press. Federal officials are investigating whether millions of dollars are being steered improperly toward a government contractor to run the country's largest counterterrorism exercise. At issue is a written request for companies to compete for the Topoff 5 exercise contract, and whether an employee of Science Applications International Corporation, SAIC, wrote parts of the proposal, according to officials familiar with the contract, who, of course, spoke on condition of anonymity. It would be considered a conflict of interest if an SAIC employee both drafted the document and intends to compete for the contract, according to Melanie Sloan, director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. That's citizensforethics.org. Crew. FEMA would not say how much Topoff 5 and its contract is worth. The last exercise cost about $25 million, and the contract, under dispute right now, has not yet been awarded. But you can be sure, MediaMonarchy.com and folks like Greg Nixon at DailyDoseOfTerror.blogspot.com covering all the drills and war games. Moving now to Click on Detroit. This is scary. Israeli police talk with Michigan Homeland Security. Michigan Attorney General Mike Cox, with a link for you, hosted a conference Thursday that brought more than 200 law enforcement leaders together to meet with members of the Israeli National Police to discuss security issues. Homeland security issues regarding the Detroit-Windsor tunnel were expected to be discussed. The meeting was one in a series of exchanges between American and Israeli law security agencies, but it's the first one to ever be held in Michigan. And so there's a link. There's lots of links. Lots and lots of links for you to go down researching on MediaMonarchy.com. I can only hit some of them, but it's all there for you to do your own research, please. But if we, I believe, jump back just a few weeks ago, we know that we had Michael Chertoff, head of Stasiland Security, talk about putting in Israeli technology in the airports. And of course, we're going to get more into airports as we further on down the road. But let's look beyond a little bit, get a little geopolitical. Geopolitics, dog meat, poison, and weather war games. First up in that bizarre title is China may modify weather for Olympics. And I've hit that again and again and again, but it always keeps coming out. And they're basically saying, yes, we are going to manipulate the weather. We are working on manipulating the weather. Unless you think those things don't exist, then you better check out why the U.S. and Russia in the 70s signed agreements saying they wouldn't use weather warfare technology. So, from China Daily, Xinhua, if bad weather threatens the August 8th, 888, at 8:08 in the morning, and if you look at the rings in the Olympic logo, it's 888, and hopefully Media Monarchy will be giving you episode 88. Numerology, my friends, for the New World Order. If bad weather threatens the August 8th opening of Beijing's Olympic Games, then meteorologists may change the weather, according to Chinese meteorology official Chen Zhenlin, Z-H-E-N-L-I-N, a vice director with the China Meteorological Administration, CMA, with a link for you, made the statement last Tuesday afternoon at a press conference held at the Beijing International Media Center. Cloud seeding. Weather wars. I don't know if this is funny or sad or all those things rolled into one, but coming out of Houston, KPRC, dog meat taken off China menus for Olympics. Patrons at some restaurants in Beijing won't be able to order any canine cuisine during the next month's Olympics. Dog meat, with actually a link on Wikipedia, talks about all of it, has been struck from the menus of officially designated Olympic restaurants in Beijing. Tourism officials are telling other outlets to discourage consumers from ordering dishes made from dogs. If we jump to the AFP and hop over to the disputed zone of Iran, this surely isn't going to help things. Iran discovers billion-barrel oil field. That's billion with a B as in boy. Iran says it has discovered a new oil field containing more than 1 billion barrels of crude. Oil Minister Gholam Hossein Nozari said that the field held 1.1 billion barrels of sweet crude oil, of which 233 million could be recovered. If we jump to the AP, unions are being set up all around the globe. Whether it's the European Union, or the perhaps forthcoming North American Union, and of course there's the African Union, and on and on. Sarkozy, who actually, speaking of the European Union, I don't have this posted up yet, but he's basically going to try and force Ireland to vote again on the EU treaty, the so-called Lisbon Treaty, or whatever you want to call it. They just voted it down a few weeks ago, but Sarkozy said, hey, no, we're going to force it until we get the results that we want. You will be assimilated. But he's also running around helping to set up the Mediterranean Union. And they want to rid the world of WMD. The leaders of 43 nations from Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa have launched a Union for the Mediterranean, a brainchild of French President Nicolas Sarkozy, I'm sure it is. He thought of it himself. It didn't come from high-level meetings with internationalists. The brainchild of French President Nicolas Sarkozy that aims to improve cooperation in the region with practical projects that could parallel efforts toward Mideast peace. I'm not sure how much I hit the story of David Davis, basically a politician in the UK who resigned and said that everything's turning into an Orwellian police state. They held another election and the infamous David Icke hooked up with him and ran alongside him. So initially, what sort of looked as a guy really coming out against the brave New World Order, I believe if you follow the story put forth by David Icke, you'll find that then, as soon as he came out, a lot of shady characters aligned themselves with them, so basically steering this so-called anti-Big Brother politician. Anyway, from InfoWars and David Icke, Big Brother by-election plays out exactly as David Icke predicted. David Davis wins by a mile, and David Icke gets the very few votes he always said he would get in an election in which his focus was information nationally and internationally, not winning irrelevant votes within the small constituency area in which the election took place. While the corrupt system had its election and crowned its imposter king in its attempt to hijack the Big Brother debate in Britain, far more people are now aware of the real Big Brother, the one that David Davis and his sidekick from Liberty, Shami Chakrabarty, have no intention of talking about, let alone exposing. David Davis, an aloof and arrogant man, it turned out, refused to debate the wider aspects of the Orwellian state with David Icke and even barred him from his public events. And this is the new standard bearer for the opposition to Big Brother. It's all a scam. And there's lots of links to BBC and Press TV and David Icke that you can check all that out and read about David Davis. Speaking of the BBC, with other links layered in there in the news.co.uk and more, many UK troops feel like quitting. Almost half of UK military personnel are ready to leave the forces, a Ministry of Defense survey suggests. Some 47% of Army and Royal Navy respondents and 44% of those in the RAF said they regularly felt like quitting. Among the concerns raised by the 9,000 servicemen and women surveyed were the frequency of tours, levels of pay, and the quality of equipment and housing. The MOD said the survey revealed areas of concern, but that conditions were being improved. So it sounds like they have the same basic general situation over there that we do here. Putting a military through the meat grinder, sending them back on tour after tour after tour with shoddy equipment, even shoddier care when you get back, and it's all just meant to stir up the violence. If we jump over to The Guardian, this is an interesting one. UK intel chief in coma after collapse. The cabinet's most senior intelligence advisor was in a coma 5 days after being found unconscious at his London home. This according to Whitehall officials. Alex Allen, A-L-L-A-N, described by his colleagues as an extremely fit man and keen on sports, was rushed to hospital on Monday after he was discovered unconscious at his home, where he has lived alone since the death of his Australian wife last year. He is seriously ill and undergoing tests to try and find out what is in his system, an official said. Officials dismissed as nonsense suggestions that he might have been poisoned. But if we jump to news.9msn.com, this is out of Australia. Britain's top spy is fighting for his life amid fears he has been poisoned by a Russian agent. Alex Allen, the head of the intelligence agencies MI5, MI6, and GCHQ, was found unconscious at his West London home. The civil servant, age 56, remains in a coma as toxicology experts examine his blood. The possible assassination attempt could be linked to Allen's recent warning that Russia has become the third biggest threat to national security behind Al-Qaeda and Iran. Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who Allen regularly briefed on security issues, was not immediately informed of Allen's condition. The possible murder plot follows former KGB spy Alexander Litvinenko's death in November. The Russian dissident and writer was murdered in London amid rumors he was poisoned with radioactive polonium by Russian agents. There's really no question that he was poisoned by radioactive polonium, whether it was Russian agents or someone else, remains to be seen. That Australian article goes on, but we're going to hop back, get on track, and speak of Russia a little more. This from RIA Novosti. Russia starts large-scale naval exercise in the Pacific. Over 20 combat and auxiliary ships from Russia's Pacific Fleet started a large-scale naval exercise in the Sea of Japan, which includes live firing drills. According to the exercise scenario, here, check it out, here's the scenario. The Russian Naval Task Force and shore-based naval aircraft are tasked with the search and destruction of an aggressor force attempting to establish a beachhead on the Russian coast. The ships will conduct a series of live firing drills against ground, surface, and air targets. If we jump to the Daily Times out of Pakistan, they're reporting on something the intelligence agency / news journalist site Stratfor. Situation in Pakistan spinning out of control. The use of suicide bombings has allowed religiously radical forces to reach beyond their NWFP strongholds and strike with impunity at the core of Pakistan, including urban centers. And as it is, things are spinning out of control, according to a commentary released by Stratfor. And there's some links there for you. Stratfor, I believe, is a subscription service. But if you go through Google, you can check out the whole article. Hitting AFP, French agency press, NATO and U.S. forces suffer deadliest month in Afghanistan. June was the deadliest month for foreign troops in Afghanistan since the 2001 fall of the Taliban, and the second in a row in which casualties exceeded those in Iraq. June accounted for more than 40% of the 122 deaths of foreign soldiers in Afghanistan during 2008, according to the independent website iCasualties.org. Finally, under the geopolitics heading, Pentagon doubts Israeli intel over Iran's nuclear program. This from The Telegraph. American commanders worry that Israel will feel compelled to act within the next 12 months with no guarantee that they can do more than slow Iran's development of a weapon capable of destroying the Jewish state. Gaps in the intelligence on the precise location and vulnerabilities of Iran's facilities emerged during recent talks between Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the American Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Israeli agents. Of course, they're all over here basically lobbying or perhaps saying that they're going to attack Iran. And of course, we'll follow along with our suicide pact and follow Israel into Armageddon. So, Mike Mullen and Israeli generals met, according to an official familiar with the discussion, who has briefed Iranian experts in Washington and London. If we return to the homeland, this from bradblog.com, 238 to 180, vote in favor of impeachment hearings. There will be a hearing related to Representative Dennis Kucinich's article of impeachment against George Bush in the House Judiciary Committee. That was assured by a vote of 238 to 180 on Tuesday. But according to Olbermann on Countdown, Speaker Pelosi has mandated that questioning in the hearing be relegated to Bush's abuses of power, not his criminal wrongdoing. I guess, oh yeah, those are apples and oranges. There's never been one hearing that accumulated all the things that constitute an imperial presidency, said Judiciary Chairman and Gatekeeper John Conyers. This according to CQPolitics.com. He indicated topics covered in the hearing would include the firing of U.S. attorneys for political reasons. Of course, that's why Karl Rove just ignored his subpoena and fled the country. The betrayal of CIA agent Valerie Plame and Bush's alleged lying to Congress about the reasons for invading Iraq. Kucinich's single article of impeachment only deals with Bush's lies to Congress. So basically, he introduced the 35, and somehow one has wiggled its way through. Thanks a lot to also folks like Congressman Wexler. There were no Democratic votes against holding the hearing, while 180 Republicans voted to follow their dear leader lockstep over the cliff. 10 Republicans abstained, and 9 Republican members of Congress voted with the Democrats. One of those including some guy named Ron Paul. CampaignForLiberty.com. Kucinich promises a surprise witness against Bush. This from CQ Politics as well. Quote, an unidentified government official of a U.S. ally wants to participate if and when Kucinich makes his case to impeach President Bush before the House Judiciary Committee, according to the Ohio Democrat. To go along right nicely with this, Huffington Post, Kucinich impeachment battle no longer so quixotic. Kucinich continued his seemingly quixotic crusade to impeach President Bush last week, but with Speaker Pelosi suggesting the House Judiciary Committee may hear this argument, Kucinich might get his day very soon. The American News Project has a new video explaining Kucinich's ongoing fight. That's up on newsproject.org. And I'm not going to play that clip. I got other clips to hit up for you. There'll be plenty. This is maybe the longest I've gone in any recent show without playing a clip a half hour into it. But I got a cartoon right now. It's up, it's big, and it's a notice from the National Surveillance State. This came from Fighting Words. So this is a notice from the National Surveillance State, and there's four frames, four different scenarios. In the first one, Subject 1001-3624A, suburban area, western U.S. Face recognition and vehicle tracking software indicates numerous minor traffic infractions. Fines have been assessed. We also notice that you like to pick your nose while you drive. This information will be archived should you need to be later discredited or embarrassed. Subject 1003-6893D, urban area, eastern U.S. Biometric scans, genetic screening data, and behavior pattern analysis indicates that you only wash your hands with a 62% frequency when you eat out at restaurants. Your health insurance carrier has been notified, and your monthly premiums will be adjusted accordingly. Subject 1291-3713N, rural area, midwestern U.S. We know what you did to that sheep. It was bugged with subcutaneous RFID and GPS chips programmed to record suspicious activity and broadcast their location. You should be ashamed of yourself. And finally, Subject 1040-9625L, location classified. Investigation reveals possible subversive inclinations, questionable racial history or religious affiliation, and or other un-American activity. Your phone records, emails, internet habits, financial records, personal interactions, and choice of breakfast cereal have all been cataloged and cross-referenced. We know everything about you. Everything. That's a notice from the National Surveillance State. And of course, it's now an easy hop, skip, and a jump from the National Surveillance State to Obama's civilian national security force. That's right. We're now going to dive into all the latest exposing the fraud of Barack Obama. This is all posted up under the heading of "There's Still Time to Realize the Fraud of Obama." I've told this before. I started to wake up to 9/11 and all the shady dealings in early 2002. Still, in the 04 election, I guess I hadn't quite broken my conditioning. I still voted for Kerry because I thought it made a fucking difference. But it did not. He took the fall. And so now we're coming back up to another election. It's another 4 years, and there's another Democrat put up for people, and everybody goes, oh, God, he's going to be this, he's going to be that, and it's going to be great, and we'll get rid of Bush, and yada, yada. It's not hard to look at what's going on with Obama to debunk a lot of the audacity of change. And so there was an article, actually didn't link this up, I read it in the actual newspaper. In the New York Times, there was an article out of Portland, Oregon. They basically used it as the jumping off point because we, of course, had the big 70-plus thousand rally a few months ago in primary season. But they're basically talking about with Obama's latest moves as far as, you know, he wants to ratchet up the war. He voted for immunity. All those things and more. And, of course, all you got to do is look at who his advisors are. And we're going to get to that. It's not hard to expose all of this. And there's still time to do something about it. So let's start it off. Obama's civilian national security force. This from Kurt Nemo. It appears candidate Obama, if elected, fully intends to recruit young citizens into something he calls a, quote, national security force. Apparently a large paramilitary group, quote, just as powerful, just as strong, just as well funded, end quote, as the U.S. military. Obama made passing reference to this disturbing idea in a speech delivered in Chicago on July 2nd. As should be expected, the corporate media, with the exception of the Chicago Tribune, completely ignored the statement and its implications. It was picked up by the real media, that is to say, the bloggers, and even Joseph Farah at WorldNet Daily, who wrote, if we're going to create some kind of national police force as big, powerful, and well-funded as our combined U.S. military forces, isn't this rather a big deal? Asked Farah. I thought Democrats generally believe the U.S. spent too much on the military. How is it possible their candidate is seeking to create some kind of massive but secret national police force that will be even bigger than the Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Force put together? And then if we jump to The Guardian, he's all about the Afghan surge. Obama promises 10,000 more troops for Afghanistan. I mean, come on, somebody's got to guard the poppies. The Taliban surely isn't doing it. You know, they're actually real religious fundamentalists who, of course, destroyed all the poppy fields, you know, just a few months before 9/11, when our troops were massing on their borders before 9/11. Barack Obama pledged to increase U.S. troops in Afghanistan by a third if he becomes president, sending 10,000 more to reinforce the 33,000 already there. He was speaking after the U.S. lost 9 soldiers at the weekend in the deadliest attack on its forces in the country since 05. Obama has promised, soon after becoming president in January, to begin scaling back the 156,000 U.S. troops in Iraq and Kuwait and shift the focus to Afghanistan.
So this speech today in Washington comes just ahead of, we don't know the exact dates, but he's making trips to Iraq and Afghanistan and Israel and Britain, amongst other places. What is this all about?
He's due to go to Iraq and Afghanistan in the next week or so. The specific dates haven't been announced for security reasons. If people knew when he was going into Iraq and Afghanistan, everybody with RPG would be heading in that direction. But he will be there in the next week or two. And it's mainly, it's important for a presidential candidate to establish credibility on foreign policy. And McCain is always saying that this is Obama's weakness. So to have footage of Obama in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, will be playing back to a domestic audience, and that's the main reason. I mean, Obama has lots of foreign policy advisors, and that's where his policy will be shaped. This is mainly about electioneering.
Did you hear that? Obama has lots of foreign advisors, so this is basically just, you know, a dog and pony show electioneering. And we're going to get into a little bit about his advisors, and of course we've hit that before. It's filled with, you know, trilateralists and Skull and Bones people and Goldman Sachs. And that little edit of audio from The Guardian comes from the previous article, and it's linked up, and you can hear the whole thing. But if we jump now to The New York Times, Obama less transparent on finances than Bush and Cheney. Senators Barack Obama and John McCain have long been among the most outspoken critics of the influence of money in politics, yet records show that in their presidential campaigns, neither has lived up to their promises to fully disclose the identities of their top money collectors who bundle millions of dollars in campaign contributions. The spotty disclosure records of Obama and McCain, despite repeated entreaties from watchdog groups, compare unfavorably with that of George W. Bush in his two runs for president. Obama was saying he was the most transparent, but it wasn't even on par with Bush and Cheney, said Alexander Cohen, senior researcher at Public Citizen, citizen.org, a nonpartisan watchdog group that recently sent letters to Obama and McCain with seven other organizations calling for them to disclose the, or rather more, information about their donors. But about those advisors, this from 911blogger.com, Obama's foreign policy advisors tell us all we really need to know about him. Instead of media pundits blowing a bunch of hot air about Barack Obama's former pastor, there should be a real discussion and examination of who he has picked as his foreign policy advisors. These choices will have far more of an impact on our country than which church Obama attended or where he stands on the various partisan wedge issues. Among the 13 advisors selected, there are some alarming choices, with links for you to read more about all the others. We're only going to hit two right now. And of course, all this, especially when you consider Obama's anti-war rhetoric on the stump. The first advisor we'll mention is Indiana Congressman and Democrat Tim Romer. He was a member of the 9/11 Commission and a representative of the war profiteering weapons makers Boeing and Lockheed Martin, which also, of course, happen to be the world's largest defense contractors. Also on board is Washington insider and notorious cover-up artist Lee Hamilton. It's interesting to note that Hamilton, a Democrat, has been called upon several times to bail Republicans out of huge scandals, such as being the chair of the 9/11 Commission. And again, there's links for you there, and you can read more about Lee Hamilton up on Cooperative Research, the complete 9/11 timeline up on historycommons.org. Now, here's a strange one, and I'm not exactly sure what to make of this, but it's interesting nonetheless. This goes back a few months, and we, of course, already mentioned Obama here in Portland rallying the masses. But he was also in a town called Beaverton in Oregon, where he said the following. Check it.
Because, you know, it is just wonderful to be back in Oregon, and over the last 15 months, we've traveled to every corner of the United States. I've now been in 57 states, I think one left to go. Alaska and Hawaii I was not allowed to go to, even though I really wanted to visit, but my staff would not justify it.
Did you catch that? He said he's been so busy campaigning. Man, he's hit almost all the states. He's visited 57 states in America. Now, you hear him sort of stutter there, and I don't know if that's because there may be audible gasps in the crowd saying, there's only 50. But he even sort of stops and does the calculations. No, 57, but I haven't been to Alaska and Hawaii, so I guess there's at least 59 states in the country. Now, the only sort of speculative conspiracy theory part, and we won't get into that here, but it bears mentioning, of course, is this just some sort of absent-minded gaffe because he's overworked and running around all over the place? Or is this some bizarre reference to, of course, the North American Union? Discuss amongst yourselves. But we're going to jump now to Information Clearinghouse and Mike Whitney with his article, Worse Than McCain. Every 4 years, liberals and progressives are expected to set aside their beliefs and stand four square behind a Democratic Party candidate. This ritual is invariably performed in the name of party unity. It doesn't matter if the candidate is a smooth-talking politician who's willing to toss his pastor 20 years overboard for a few awkward comments, or whether he refuses to defend basic civil liberties like the Fourth Amendment's right to privacy. All that matters is that there's a big D following his name and that he shows he's willing to engage in some meaningless verbal jousting with his Republican opponent. For nearly a year now, the public has been treated to regular doses of Mr. Obama's grandiloquent oratory and his sweeping follow me to Shangri-La promises. These flourishes are usually followed by clarifications on the central issues which identify Obama as a center-right conservative with no intention of disrupting the status quo. Political analyst Alexander Cockburn on counterpunch.org summed it up like this. There have been plenty of articles recently with headlines such as Obama's lunge to the right. I find these odd. Never for one moment has Obama ever struck me as someone anchored or even loosely moored to the left or even displaying the slightest appetite for radical notions aside from a few taglines tossed from the campaign bus. And there's a nice graphic posted up under that one. Unauthorized government wiretaps we can believe in. It looks good, and it's nice, big quality. You can paste it up. But if we hit the last one, up on MediaMonarchy.com, all under the heading, there is still time to realize the fraud of Obama. One last bit, this from Consortium News and also Real News Network, and we're going to hear a clip of a longer video that you can watch the whole thing. In a major foreign policy speech in Washington, Obama detailed his, quote, five goals essential to making America safer if he's elected president. Obama says he will end the war in Iraq, confront al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and rebuild U.S. alliances around the world. Asia Times correspondent Pepe Escobar discusses how Obama's policies differ from McCain's and points to what he thinks are Obama's hits and misses.
Barack Obama is the man with the plan for Iraq and Afghanistan. Quoting Truman and Nixon, Kennan and Marshall, the greatest generation, it's all part of what Obama calls his new overarching strategy.
I will focus this strategy on five goals essential to making America safer. Ending the war in Iraq responsibly. Finishing the fight against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Securing all nuclear weapons and materials from terrorists and rogue states. Achieving true energy security and rebuilding our alliances to meet the challenges of the 21st century.
Obama's plan is more realistic, thoughtful, and sensible than the Bush-McCain road to victory in Iraq.
Senator McCain wants to talk about our tactics in Iraq. I want to focus on a new strategy for Iraq and the wider world.
But does Obama's safe redeployment in Iraq automatically translate into no U.S. troops by the summer of 2010? No, it translates into this.
We will keep a residual force to perform specific missions in Iraq, targeting any remnants of Al-Qaeda, protecting our service members and diplomats, and training and supporting Iraq's security forces so long as the Iraqis make political progress.
Al-Qaeda in Iraq is just one component of the Islamic State of Iraq. That's an umbrella jihadi organization. They have no more than 1,000 jihadis. Obama does admit,
true success will take place when we leave Iraq to a government that is taking responsibility for its future. A government that prevents sectarian conflict and ensures that the Al-Qaeda threat, which has been beaten back by our troops, does not reemerge.
But when Iraq is in charge of their own security, you don't need U.S. soldiers. Obama also does not explain how many will be part of this U.S. residual force. Hundreds, thousands. Without speaking Arabic, with no access to local intelligence, what exactly would they be doing in Iraq? And who will judge who's a terrorist and who's not? The Baghdad government or, once again, Washington? U.S. corporate media has given a blank check to John McCain on foreign policy. McCain says the surge in Iraq is working, the war may go on for 100 years, and let's bomb, 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 bomb Iran. Obama, on the other hand, recognizes that,
in fact, as should have been apparent to President Bush and Senator McCain, the central front in the war on terror is not Iraq. and it never was.
The problem is when Obama tackles the, I quote, broader strategic goals.
I will send at least 2 additional combat brigades to Afghanistan and use this commitment to seek greater contributions with fewer restrictions from our NATO allies.
Obama suggests tenuous hints of a mini Marshall Plan for Afghanistan, already promised and not delivered by the U.S. in late 2001.
That's why I've proposed an additional $1 billion in non-military assistance each year with meaningful safeguards to prevent corruption. We cannot lose Afghanistan to a future of narco-terrorism.
Obama basically frames the U.S. mission in Afghanistan as a fight against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The problem is the U.S. has not captured any Al-Qaeda operative for ages, and the historical Al-Qaeda leadership is in the Pakistani tribal areas, not Afghanistan. So what's the purpose of having an extra 10,000 U.S. troops in search and destroy missions, very dangerous, in eastern Afghanistan, and bound to inflict inevitable collateral damage on civilian peasants? Even the Pentagon now admits it's fighting an asymmetrical war in Afghanistan, and it's against a mix of all kinds of people. Taliban, disgruntled Pashtun tribal chiefs, and warlords financed by who? The CIA in the 1980s. This has nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. It's about Afghans refusing what they see as foreign occupation by the US and NATO. Exactly like Sunnis and Shiites in Iraq fighting against foreign occupation.
That's just a little bit from Consortium News and the Real News Network, Obama's Brave New World, and you can watch that whole thing. And I, again, implore you to go to MediaMonarchy.com and do, you know, a couple searches, click a couple things, and you can expose the whole fraud that you're being subjected to. But we're going to move on now. We're going to hit back on the AFP. Interestingly enough, we've already mentioned informants and provocateurs. Let's talk about 311. And no, not that terrible band from the 90s. Spain's Supreme Court acquits 4 over 311 bombings. Spain's Supreme Court Thursday overturned the convictions of 4 of the 21 people condemned to prison over the Madrid train bombings that killed 191 people in March 11th, 2004, 911 days after 9/11. It also upheld a lower court's decision to acquit one of the alleged masterminds of the Al-Qaeda-inspired attacks, Rabbi Usman Saeed Ahmed, known as Muhammad the Egyptian. The early morning bombings on 4 packed commuter trains on March 11, 2001, or rather 2004, were the deadliest terror attacks in the West since 9/11. Now, more importantly, let's jump to an article from Kurt Nimmo. More evidence Madrid bombing was a false flag op. And I chopped it out a little bit. He includes long portions of some of the article I just read to you from the AFP. But he says, note, the attack is no longer considered the direct handiwork of Al-Qaeda, but is rather an Al-Qaeda-inspired attack. Back in March 2004, the corporate media resoundingly declared Al-Qaeda to be responsible. So in other words, according to Spain's Supreme Court, these people did not belong to a terrorist group, at least not an Islamic terrorist group. Apparently, there was not enough evidence to stay the conviction of Muhammad the Egyptian, said to be the ringleader, and his conviction was thrown out as well. As it turns out, Trashoras and a compatriot Antonio Toro were government informants, a fact reported by the New York Times and the Times Online, timesonline.co.uk, with a link for you to read about those informants, government informants. Toro was recently handed a 4-year prison sentence for transporting explosives. The aforementioned History Commons on the Cooperative Research website notes the following. It is revealed that the man accused of supplying the dynamite used in the March 2004 Madrid train bombings was an informant who had the private telephone number of the head of Spain's Civil Guard bomb squad. In short, Trashoras and Toro are patsies, and the evidence indicates the Spanish Civil Guard bomb squad was behind the bombing, and a phantom Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorist group was simply a contrivance designed to feed public hysteria. So again, another big major event, another case of patsies and government informants and prior knowledge. 7-7, 3-11, 9-11, OKC, JFK, you name it. If we jump now to WBZ-TV, American Airlines testing anti-missile technology. Now, I was able to hop over to WBZ-TV and swipe the video from their website, and I posted it up for you. So here's the story from WBZ, American Airlines testing anti-missile technology.
American Airlines is now using a defense system designed right here in New England.
And as WBZ's chief correspondent Joe Shortsleeve explains, a New Hampshire company is hoping that all planes soon will have this technology on board.
You can almost touch the planes as they roar over Point Shirley and Winthrop on their way to Logan Airport. The passengers were checked for explosives before they got on. However, a growing concern is what could happen away from the airport. Terrorists firing a shoulder-launched missile just outside the airport's property. These lightweight weapons are becoming more and more available on the black market. As many as 150,000 are believed to be in circulation and can easily bring down a plane. But now American Airlines is flying with new defensive technology on some of its New York to Los Angeles flights. Developed in New Hampshire by defense contractor BAE Systems, the cross-country passenger jets are now equipped with a laser deterrent system mounted on the plane's belly. It can identify and misdirect an incoming missile. It's being tested for Homeland Security.
Over several years, we've been testing and validating the system, so now it's really great to see it's at this point where we're really now on a in-service passenger aircraft.
American Airlines is not using the technology on any Boston-based flights at this point. At $1 million per plane, the missile defense system is expensive, and that's a significant hurdle.
You never know when they're going to come up and surprise you, and might save a lot of lives.
Does it make you feel safer?
Yes, I think so.
BAE Systems is one of two defense contractors hoping to win a government contract. Congress will decide the future of this technology before next summer. Joe Shortsleeve, WBZ News.
Pretty scary, though. Experts say as many as 27 different terrorist organizations have the shoulder missile weapons. And by the way, they sell for as little as $10,000.
There's a good bit of fear-mongering there from WBZ-TV. Airplanes to get anti-missile technology. And they mention, of course, the terrorist organizations. And, of course, how many of those are, of course, informant, patsy, government-connected? I guess we'll find out, but it's ridiculous. I think I've mentioned this before. It's what Lisa Simpson would call specious reasoning. You ask the woman, I guess I feel safer. I don't know. I got this rock. It keeps away wild animals. I don't see any wild animals around, so it must be working. But let's jump to Chicago now. Illinois governor may send National Guard into Chicago to fight crime. That's right, now that we don't have that pesky posse comitatus that prevented the military from performing domestic functions. Now that we got that pesky shit out of the way, Illinois Governor Rod... I'm going to play the clip, and they say his name, but they say it really quickly. And it's not exactly as it looks like, but it looks like Blagojevich. But they say, like, Blagojevich. So, sorry. Basically, Illinois Governor on Wednesday signed a new law that will put in place tougher penalties for selling guns to minors. That's the nice front showy thing that everybody goes, oh, well, that sounds good. He also announced he's got a new idea to help combat the violence that Chicago is experiencing. He's talked to the Illinois State Police and the National Guard to see if they could help.
Governor Rob Blagojevich today signed a new law. It will put in place tougher penalties for selling guns to minors. He also announces he's got a big new idea to help combat the violence Chicago is experiencing. He is talking to the Illinois State Police and the National Guard to see if they can help.
And might be able to free up some resources that the Chicago Police uses for capital needs to be able maybe to hire more police officers or possibly ask some to come out of retirement to put them into these violent zones, hot zones, where clearly, I think, part of the challenge is that gangbangers outnumber police officers 5-1.
The summer of 2008 will be remembered as especially violent. Blagojevich says there's been a child shot in Chicago nearly every day since June 26. Bringing in state troopers, even National Guard helicopters to high crime areas is still very much, though, in the planning stages.
I don't care where they come from. They could come from Kalamazoo. If we get officers on the streets fighting crime, that's a good thing.
There are way too many guns on the street, and the police seem to be outmanned, and so something needs to happen to protect the children, the women and children in our community.
Blagojevich's offer is tied to his hope of passing a big capital spending bill. That would free up even more resources to hire additional police.
There are retired Chicago police officers, there are retired Illinois state troopers who might be willing and probably would be willing to get back in it and be helpful to the community during this difficult time.
The mayor's office says tonight, we're obviously not going to turn away help on a front as important as this. At the same time, we're a little puzzled about how it would work. It's unprecedented and obviously help in the form of reducing the number of guns on the streets would go a long way to addressing the problem. That is from the mayor's spokesman, Jackie Hurd. But, you know, this is just in the planning stages. No one's going to say no just yet, but it's probably still a long way from putting it into action.
Thank you, Mary Ann.
There you go, my friends. How about instead of sending in the National Guard, you send in, I don't know, maybe jobs? An economy? But let's jump back overseas again, this time to Reuters. U.S. and China to hold disaster drills. The U.S. hopes to conduct its first ever humanitarian disaster relief drills with the Chinese military in late 2009 or 10, the head of U.S. Pacific Command said on Wednesday. Admiral Timothy Keating said he and Lieutenant General Zhang Qinxing, a senior commander of the People's Liberation Army, had agreed to begin, quote, active consideration of the formulation of a plan that will lead to humanitarian assistance exercises relatively soon. The U.S. military, which has long sought to engage China's fast-growing but secretive armed forces to avoid clashes in the Pacific, had held search and rescue and signaling drills with the Chinese, but never full disaster relief exercises, Keating told an audience at the Heritage Foundation. Our good neocon think tank friends at the Heritage Foundation. If we now jump to globalsecurity.org, always keeping an eye out on the drills and the war games. The latest is called Operation Brimstone. Operation Brimstone flexes allied force training. More than 15,000 service members from four countries will participate in Joint Task Force Exercise JTFEX08-4 Operation Brimstone, July 21st through the 31st in North Carolina and off the eastern U.S. coast from Virginia all the way to Florida. JTFEX Operation Brimstone serves as a ready-for-deployment certification event for the Theodore Roosevelt Carrier Strike Group and the Iwo Jima Expeditionary Strike Group. The exercise will also serve as a joint task force capable headquarters sustainment event. This all gets a little heavy with military jargon because it's basically a press release from the joint task force exercise. But there are lots of links in there that you can read more about the carrier strike groups and the drills. Hampton Roads, as well as Navy.mil and Stratfor.com yet again. More and more drills, my friends. It's itchy trigger fingers all around the world. We're sitting on a powder keg and all it needs is a spark. Will that spark be real or will it be some provocateur event? We shall see. But we're now into hour number two of Media Monarchy, episode 84. It's July 18th, 2008. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you, as always, from the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.org, and RevereRadioNetwork.com. An important anniversary to notice and to take note of. What was the day? I believe it was the 16th. July 16th, JFK Jr. dies in the plane crash in 1999. So we have two different reports here. The first is from FindingDulcinea.com, and let's call this the accidental version. At 9:30 p.m., the Piper Saratoga floated through the fog over the Atlantic Ocean, flying it from New Jersey to Cape Cod. John F. Kennedy Jr. sat in the pilot's seat beside his wife, Carolyn, and sister-in-law, Lauren. Kennedy, a new pilot, planned to drop Carolyn off in Martha's Vineyard and then continue to Hyannisport, where his cousin Rory was getting married. Suddenly, the plane fell off the radar, plummeting 14,000 feet in 14 seconds and crashing into the water just off Martha's Vineyard. U.S. Coast Guard officials immediately began a search rescue. And in the days that followed, the Air Force, Navy, and civilians scoured the waters in hopes of saving the trio. The crash, which occurred just 17 months after Kennedy's cousin Michael died in a skiing accident, was one in a series of tragedies that has shaken the Kennedys. Of course, JFK, RFK. Luggage from the crash surfaced on July 17th. As days passed, Americans began to lose hope that any passengers would be found alive. On July 21st, divers recovered the three bodies 8 miles offshore. Officials reported that the crash was the result of Kennedy's inexperience as a pilot, combined with low visibility conditions on the night of July 16th. A memorial ceremony for the three was held on July 22nd, where their remains were scattered at sea from a Navy destroyer, the USS Briscoe. That's the accidental version. Now let's look at the conspiratorial version. This from Michael Rivera, whatreallyhappened.com. As first reported by the UPI, with a link for you, John F. Kennedy Jr., on approach to Martha's Vineyard in 8 mile visibility, was in radio contact with the ground, calmly informing them of his intentions to drop off a passenger before proceeding to Hyannis Airport. Then, according to ABC News, JFK Jr.'s plane went into a steep dive and crashed. However, even before the wreckage was found, the story being put out in the media began to change. Gone was the previously reported radio conversation a calm JFK Jr. had with ground personnel just before the plane fell out of the sky, replaced by a declaration from the NTSB that JFK Jr. had not used his radio at all as he approached Martha's Vineyard. Gone was also the originally reported 8 mile visibility, while the media began to hammer home the claim that Martha's Vineyard had been totally blanketed with a haze so heavy that pilots in the air would have been blind. No sooner were the various stories put out, but they quickly fell apart. And there's links in there, and you can read articles from Ken Thomas up on conformist.com, as well as zoneoftruth.com/JFK Jr. I'm not going to play a clip, but posted up along with this is the fantastic documentary by John Hankey, The Assassination of JFK Jr. He also made JFK 2, The Bush Connection, and again, you should definitely watch both of those. What he gets into in the assassination of JFK Jr. is all the discrepancies between the reports and when the Coast Guard actually started to look, and that it basically took Ted Kennedy waking up Bill Clinton in the middle of the night to say, "Yo, can we search?" And it goes into, was there another person added on board? They basically waited for a long time, and then did someone else get on the plane? The assertion, the idea, was this extra fourth person, the Manchurian candidate, who at the appropriate time flipped the switch, turned off the transponder, and killed the plane. It's all there for you. There's also an article linked up, related, from CapitalNews9.com, local pilot writing book on JFK Jr. plane crash. I'm not going to go into that because he's basically talking about how cloudy it was. But if we jump now to the AP, and of course I always like anything that has to do with my home state of West Virginia and Charles Manson. Manson documentary scene shot in West Virginia town. A new documentary about Charles Manson may feature a scene shot in a section of Martinsburg that looks a lot like San Francisco. Pamela Haynes, director of the West Virginia Film Office, says producers provided reference photos of the Haight-Ashbury district where Manson spent time in the 60s. She says it was the spitting image of North Queen Street where a film crew worked last Monday. Sirens Media is producing the film for MSNBC. Faith Gaskins, the recreation producer, says other scenes have been shot in Jessup and Silver Spring, Maryland. The untitled film is expected to air next year, the 40th anniversary of the murders of actress Sharon Tate and six other people by Manson followers. Manson is played by Charlie Davidson, an actor from Silver Spring. Now, some of that seems to be a little bit of a misnomer. It doesn't sound like it's going to be a film. It sounds like it's an MSNBC documentary with lots of probably hokey recreations. But hey, they shot it in Martinsburg, and I'm going to be there, or at least cruising through there, here in the next few days. Interestingly enough, right along with this story, again from the AP, release denied for dying Charles Manson followers.
A follower of Charles Manson, who is dying of brain cancer, is going to spend the rest of her days incarcerated.
Why should we continue to incarcerate her at this point in her life?
Late this afternoon, the state parole board denied parole for Susan Atkins. She was asking for what's called a compassionate release. She's 60 years old. She was sentenced to life in prison in 1970 for the cold killing of actress Sharon Tate and six other people. Atkins is currently bedridden at a hospital in Corona, near the prison where she has been serving her sentence. Her husband says she only has 3 months to live.
Back to the AP article. Atkins, convicted in the slayings of actress Sharon Tate and others in 1969, is dying of brain cancer and asked that she be granted compassionate release from prison. She wants to spend her final months surrounded by family and friends, not prison guards. Susan has served a life sentence. Virginia Seals, Atkins' sister-in-law, said in arguing that the state's longest-serving female inmate be freed. This is about her death. In a unanimous decision, the California Board of Parole hearings denied the request Tuesday. Her lawyer said he has filed a separate motion in Los Angeles County Superior Court seeking his client's release anyway. One little funny personal note is actually my first and high school girlfriend. Her name was Susan Atkins. There's only a D to a T there, and I know my friend Tony used to always get a kick out of, like, oh, you're going out with Susan Atkins. He, of course, was already tuned into all the bizarre occult dealings of the Manson family and all that. I was a latecomer. Anyway, shifting gears, time for a little bit of fun. It's time for some campaigning. The fine folks at Jib Jab poke fun at the presumptive nominees, surrogates, and a few commentators in their new cartoon satirizing the 2008 election. The new cartoon is titled Time for Some Campaignin'.
Come gather round, Dick Condit, Scooter, and Rove. It's time to get packing. We must hit the road. But there's war and recession and bad mortgage loans.
And our legacy needs saving.
So forget he's a jackass who's liberally prone.
Oh, it's time for some campaigning.
Old party friends, time to say au revoir. We failed to extinguish Barack's rising star.
You were so close, my darling. Alas, no cigar.
Changing. I'll be back in 4 years. Heck, it ain't all that far.
Oh, it's time for some campaigning.
Gather conservatives, lend me a hand. Unless you want this liberal box in command. I spent years in a rat hole in North Vietnam.
Now the GOP is contained.
So forget my skin cancer and swollen left gland. Oh, it's time for some campaigning.
Gosh, I'm so tired of divisive exchange, and I got one or two things to say about change. Like the change we must change to the change we hold dear. I really like change, and I made myself clear.
So don't talk about change till you're deaf in the ear. Oh, it's time for some campaign. Citizens gather from both far and near for a ritual we practice every 4 years when we promise you anything.
Time for some campaign, and that's the new song and video from Jib Jab. The song is great, only surpassed actually by the video. You gotta check it out. It's really just beautifully well made, well animated. Dovetailing with that, sidebar notice, back to bradblog.com. It never came up in the GOP primaries. The mainstream media won't dare mention it. Even John McCain's most liberal opponents won't go there. But leave it to equal opportunity offenders brothers Evan and Greg Spiridellis and their animation team at Jib Jab to introduce into the 2008 presidential campaign the allegations that John McCain cooperated with the enemy when he was a prisoner of war in Vietnam. Not that most people will notice it, the reference comes about 1 minute into the group's latest campaign video, Time for Some Campaignin', when the McCain character sings that he spent years in a rat hole in North Vietnam over animated graphics showing him swinging in a birdcage. A reference to the fact that McCain's accusers refer to him as Songbird. A charge as heinous as collaborating with the enemy may sound like liberal revenge for the swift voting of John Kerry by Republicans in 04, but the allegations against McCain come from conservatives, notably including former Representative Bob Dornan of California and former Senator Bob Smith of New Hampshire, both of whom are Republicans. I saw that part in the video before I saw that article, and I didn't necessarily think that it was a Birdcage reference. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. Check it out for yourself. Time for some campaigning. Now it's time for me to speed it up and move along if we're going to get through all the terrible news this week on episode 84. Right now, let's get into all the latest on the granddaddy of them all, the assassination of JFK. This one's all under Oswald's wallet, frame 313 in the Dicta Belt. The first one we're going to hit is The Tale of Two Wallets. This from George Bailey up on oswaldsmother.blogspot.com. After Oswald is arrested at the movie theater, he refused to identify himself. After searching him, his wallet is retrieved, containing an ID for Lee H. Oswald and a second ID for the Alec Heidel alias. And there's a link for you there to read about that if you've never heard the name Alec Heidel, A-L-E-K-H-I-D-E-L-L. Here comes the rub. Back at the Tippit murder scene, the wallet is now in the hands of a Dallas police captain, W.R. Westbrook. FBI agent Robert M. Barrett appears and is asked by Westbrook if he knows whom Lee Oswald or Alec Heidel is. Apparently, Captain Westbrook examined the contents. Barrett says no. You'd think that this would be a damning piece of evidence to put Oswald away for the Tippit murder, but that's not the case. The wallet seems to fade out in the story. Barrett does not report this incident in his official FBI report, but does tell James Hosty when he is writing his book, Assignment Oswald, in 1966, and there's a link for you to Google Books to check it out. So he does tell James Hosty when he's writing his book, Assignment Oswald, about the details of his visit to the murder scene and being asked about Oswald and Heidel. Next, if we hit the Hartford Courant, there's a new documentary out, and it's called Frame 313, The JFK Assassination Theories.
November 22nd, 1963. A date that is etched into the memories of most Americans. Dealey Plaza, Dallas, Texas. Theory 1. The Warren Commission report. The JFK was killed by a single gunman. Lee Harvey Oswald. Theory 2. The JFK was killed by a CIA mafia conspiracy. Theory 3. The Soviet Union KGB investigation. Theory 4. JFK was killed by mafia hitmen. Theory 5. JFK was killed by a CIA Cuban exiles conspiracy. Each theory has some merit, but it is up to you to decide what really happened on November 22nd, 1963.
So that's kind of a badly edited trailer for Frame 313, but if we return to the article in the Hartford Courant, this documentary sets out five theories about who killed President Kennedy, including the Warren Commission conclusion that Oswald acted alone. It doesn't promote a conspiracy-based alternative, though after hearing about evidence assembled by the 77-79 congressional investigation, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, plus claims of CIA and or mafia involvement from various authorities, it's almost impossible to believe there wasn't more to it than Oswald. There are any number of people who claim knowledge or even involvement in the plot. There's even a guy in prison who says he shot Kennedy from the grassy knoll. I was aware of the gist of these other theories, which all involve the CIA or mafia or both, but not the details. This is an immensely interesting, informative, provocative movie. And that's Frame 313. If we jump quickly to AskMen.com, I truncated it down a bit, but five things you don't know about the JFK assassination. It's not uncommon for death to be good business, but in the case of the assassination of JFK, it's become an industry unto itself. And what's easy to overlook is you click through the phenomenal amount of info concerning the event, such as the locales, films, and nonsense conspiracy theories, is that a man lost his life in a brutal manner. That said, and with the recent discovery of files related to the assassination by the Dallas County DA's office, we felt it was time to uncover five things you didn't know about the JFK assassination. Number one, Woody Harrelson's father was an informal suspect. That's Charles Harrelson. Number two, the public first saw the assassination footage 12 years after the shooting. And that was, of course, on the once good Geraldo Rivera show, Good Night America. Something like that, I may have mentioned this before, gives me hope that maybe in relating to 9/11, we haven't seen our Zapruder film yet. Number three, 32 cameras were in Dealey Plaza. Yeah, there's lots of footage. I bet you've never seen the Nix film. Number four, before 9/11, it was the longest uninterrupted news event in TV history. And five, at least one bystander was wounded. And that was, of course, James Tague. If we now jump to Newsweek, they've got an article, a little editorial written by Arthur Schlesinger Jr., of course, chums with the Kennedy brothers, and now, of course, aligning himself with the latest JFK, Obama. What if RFK had survived, is his article. And I'm not going to go into it, because I'm going to jump to a small little paper here out of Oregon, the Corvallis Gazette-Times. They have an interesting article, The Remastermind. Dictaphone Pro helps refine JFK recording. It's been 45 years since Bill McWilliams first became immersed in the continuing investigation of the assassination of JFK. I was right in the middle of it all, he says. He still is in his own way. From his home in North Albany, McWilliams works with engineers at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California, trying to determine the exact number of shots fired in Dallas, Texas on 11/22/63. This, of course, is all the reference to the police radio that just happened to be open during the assassination captured audio recording. Finally, under all these JFK updates, it's another mention of James Douglas and his new book, JFK and the Unspeakable. I, of course, recorded his talk here in Portland several weeks ago, and that's up, and it's actually had well over 100 or so downloads. This from Abilene Reporter News. Author sees redemptive violence at work in JFK's death. Catholic peace activist Jim Douglas of Birmingham, Alabama, believes in conspiracy theories, including the big daddy of them all, the conspiracy to kill JFK. There is no mystery as to how and why and by whom he was assassinated, Douglas said. He was killed by a high-level national security state organized by the CIA. He was not carrying out what his national security state wanted. If we jump now to WSMV, linked up from MSNBC, another disturbing bit from Police State USA. Memphis cops use amnesia shot instead of the taser. While the Metro Police had banned the use of tasers for a time, they still used a controversial method to subdue unruly people, according to an I-Team report. The city's policy to use the method, which calls for the injection of a drug into a person, came as a total surprise to people most would expect to know all about it. For almost 2 years, Metro Police, and I link up to their website, memphispolice.com, have had the option of calling for a needle loaded with a strong sedative to control the most unruly people they encounter on the street. The drug is called Midazolam, M-I-D-A-Z-O-L-A-M, which is better known as Versed, V-E-R-S-E-D, with links for you to read more about the pharma drugs. Police who have had, or rather, people who have had a colonoscopy have probably had a shot of the drug for the procedure. The drug has an amnesia effect, and we use that therapeutically because one of the nice ways to take care of the discomfort is to make people forget they've had it, said biomedical ethics and law enforcement expert Dr. Stephen Miles. So, I believe it was Houston and perhaps other places that we have cops taking people's blood at checkpoints, and now we find out that Memphis cops for 2 years have been shooting people with an amnesia drug. Don't amnesia me, bro. Jumping back to the AP, and it's the ISP I love to hate. Feds say Comcast violates internet rules. The head of the SEC said Thursday he will recommend that the nation's largest cable company be punished for violating agency principles that guarantee customers open access to the internet. The potentially precedent-setting move stems from a complaint against Comcast that the company had blocked internet traffic among users of a certain type of file-sharing software that allows them to exchange large amounts of data. It's called BitTorrenting. And I'm doing it now. There's, of course, links there at the bottom. Flashbacks so you can read about Comcast cameras to start watching you, and Comcast pays stand-ins to keep protesters out of an FCC hearing. And we've had all those stories in the recent months on MediaMonarchy.com. Now we come to what I referenced at the top of the show. Out of these troubled times, our fifth objective can emerge. A new world order. Those words were spoken by George H.W. Poppy Bush on September 11th, 1990, 11 years to the day before 9/11. And there's documentation you can link up and see that he for real said that. And of course, that's one of the numerous times he talked about a new world order. An article from thepeoplesvoice.org is W, an agent of the new world order. When you mention the word conspiracy to explain a situation, most people tune you right out. They think you're a wacko. Yet, the U.S. Congress, as dumb as it is, subscribes to the proposition that there is such a thing. After the Civil War, it passed a law, the Sherman Antitrust Act, to make it a crime for two or more individuals to agree to fix the price of goods in restraint of trade. Every day in America, in both the state and federal courts, a defendant faces charges dealing with the crime of conspiracy. Conspiracy is as American as apple pie. Therefore, I submit that the evidence is compelling that there is an ongoing conspiracy hatched by the New World Order to reduce the U.S. to a vassal state, which leads me to this question. Is W. President George W. Bush Jr. one of its covert agents? The last 7.5 years have been an absolute disaster for the American Republic. Under W's reign, we have suffered with lethal wars of choice in both Iraq and Afghanistan, resulting in huge casualty numbers, a failing economy with a loss of hundreds of thousands of middle-class jobs, a sharp decline in the value of stocks and the dollar, too, Katrina and massive flooding in the heartland of America, prompted in part by global warming and defective levees, and a foreclosure rate in the housing market that mirrors the worst days of the Great Depression. The article is lengthy, but I'm going to stop there. But it basically brings up the question that, yes, of course, he's here to help destroy this country. Now, of course, Bush is in charge of nothing. I've never subscribed to the notion that Bush knew about 9/11. He was hiding out in Florida with his brother, who had just days prior signed a secret national emergency, or rather statewide emergency, while Poppy Bush was in the White House on September 10th. And we're going to get to, of course, all the meetings that went on with ISI and Pakistan and CIA and Porter Gross and all that. But basically, I explain it like this. You may have heard me say this, you may not have. You remember that scene in Goodfellas when they're running the bar and they're basically using it as a front to move liquor and smokes in through the front and out through the back? And at some point when they've basically maxed everything out and done all they can do, they finally realize they got to burn it down. That's what's happening right now. They have looted us out. They've pulled all the copper wiring out. They've got your pensions, your Social Security, all of it. And now they're just going to burn the bar down and collect the insurance. And of course, then they'll pose as our saviors. So, like I said, that article is up and it's longer. Is W an agent of the New World Order? So speaking of just one of those points that was mentioned, and that's the economic meltdown, my friends. Under the heading economic meltdown, just heating up, we've got a bunch of links. Some thanks to my man Doug at blacklistednews.com. Wholesale inflation is worst in 27 years. That's from the AP. Stocks drop again amid fears about financials. That's from biz.yahoo.com. Fannie Freddie Lifeline puts taxpayers on the hook. That's again Yahoo. Analyst warns on Wachovia amid more bank worries. Bernanke signals growth risks and intensified inflation danger. That's from Bloomberg, and you gotta love the fact that they always still talk about, oh, it's the growth is a little slow. I guess they, you know, the glass is half full. And then Citigroup shares drop to lowest price since 1998. That again from Bloomberg. So, dollar free fall, new record low. The dollar declined to a record low against the euro on speculation. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Helicopter Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson will say credit market losses are hurting U.S. economic growth. Now, to put a nice human face on all this stuff, you've, of course, heard about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac And then you also heard about IndyMac. So from the Daily News and InfoWars and Bloomberg and RogueGovernment.com, cops threatened to arrest angry IndyMac customers. Police ordered angry customers lined up outside an IndyMac bank branch to remain calm or face arrest Tuesday as they tried to pull their money on the second day of the failed institution's federal takeover.
You know that IndyMac Bank shut down Friday and has been taken over by federal regulators, and they have reopened the bank. What is happening at this hour there, Eric?
Well, this particular branch and all of them actually opens at 8 o'clock this morning, and there's a little bit of tension here. We got people in line here behind this yellow tape. These are people who were put on a list yesterday. They waited all day yesterday, and their names were put on a list, and they were told to come back this morning. And then these people showed up over here, and they were not on the list, and they feel they should be allowed in the bank first to go in and withdraw their money. And, of course, the people whose names are on the list, they believe they should be allowed in first. So there's an argument taking place here, and it's gotten kind of loud, and the police have been called in. You see there's a couple of officers over there. There's security here as well. At this point, what the bank is telling people is, if your name is on the list, you can get in. If it isn't, you need to go home. You come over here to this this manager. He is telling these people whose names were not on the list that they ought to go home.
To get you guys a handout with all the questions and answers from the FDIC. If you have questions on your account, we'll have the FDIC come back through the line and answer questions. Maybe you don't have to be here today. Maybe you can come back in another day. The bank will stay open and you won't have to wait in this line.
Some of these people are not happy with that explanation. They're here. Some of these people have been here since 1:45 a.m. Let's come on down the line, maybe talk to a few of them. You've been waiting here for hours. Now they're telling you you have to go home because your name's not on the list.
What?
That's what they're saying.
Well, let me get on another list then. I mean, that's nonsense. This morning, the FDIC announced through the news they weren't honoring anybody on this list. It was first come, first serve. They know nothing about this list. It wasn't from them on their official letterhead. Now the same guy who said, I'm not doing a list, is now saying, I'm honoring a list. He's a hypocrite, and he's a bold-faced liar, and this is who's representing us and in charge of our money today? That's nonsense. There are people here who need money to pay their bills. This is nonsense. They should alternate 1-1, 1-1. They should not take the list people first. It should be an alternated thing. I mean, there's one guy that's been here since 11:30 last night. I've been here since 5:30 this morning. I mean, they should have at least had the decency to have a representative out here early and not wait till 7:45 to start doing this. This is badly managed, and apparently, according to the new CEO of this lovely IndyMac bank, he was going to make everything run smoother and do what was ever necessary. Well, he ought to get off his ass and come out here.
Thank you for talking to us. I know you were angry too.
Yes, and he's talking to you, and he's talking to me, and he's going to be talking to everybody. Hopefully, if there's a bright side of any of this, it should hopefully open people's eyes up to, well, why doesn't the bank have my money? I gave them money. They're supposed to have it. It's a fucking fraud. For every dollar you give them, they can loan out 10. Read Creature from Jekyll Island and watch The Money Masters and learn about the fraudulent nature of our banks in fiat currency and the Federal Reserve. It's made up. It's zeros and ones. And there's another article from Bloomberg posted up about Washington Mutual, one of the big banks here in Oregon, and it's all around, but we're going to move on, and we're now going to move to episode 50 of Collateral News, one of my favorite news shows up on YouTube. Collateral News, the newest episode, is called Would It Surprise You?
Mike, we're getting unconfirmed reports from Tehran that explosions were heard throughout the city late last night. One blog has a live feed of Iranian anti-aircraft fire. Another has images of a damaged U.S. Navy destroyer. The report we just gave isn't true, but with the way the corporate media is carrying on about war with Iran, how much would it surprise you if it was? Welcome to Collateral.
Wait, let me ask you this. What is going on with the president talking about World War III?
what the Iranians are doing is killing American servicemen and women.
Of course, I don't think that's banging the war drum.
It's ideally suited for attacking targets in Israel. It's got just the range you'd need for it.
Sabers are rattling in the Middle East. Iran is defiantly testing its arsenal of missiles and has vowed to continue its nuclear program. The U.S. has responded by demanding that the tests stop, promising ominously to defend its interests and those of its allies, which means Israel.
Well, the question was, if Iran were to launch a nuclear attack on Israel, what would our response be? And I want the Iranians to know that if I'm the president, we will attack Iran. We would be able to totally obliterate them. That's a terrible thing to say, but those people who run Iran need to understand that.
Meanwhile, the cable TV blathersphere is dutifully ratcheting up the hysteria.
We should have bombed somebody in Iran, then we'd bring them to the table, just like President Nixon did to the Vietnamese.
These people are bent on destroying us, General. They want to kill us.
These people are out to kill us.
Just a few months ago, remember, there was a confrontation in the Strait of Hormuz that put us, as one newspaper reported, 2 minutes from war. Conventional wisdom is that a military confrontation with Iran would send the price of petroleum skyrocketing and trigger who knows what kind of chaos. Sane people in the U.S., which is most of us, obviously don't want that. Yet why aren't we hearing that view trumpeted on the cable TV news programs? If the corporate media wants to do something useful, it should analyze the behind-the-scenes moves on the part of the U.S. government and its lobbyists to bring us closer to war with Iran. First, it was recently revealed that the U.S. is ramping up its covert special operations in Iran, a preparing of the battlefield effort, if you will, as recently reported by The New Yorker earlier this month. By itself, that should cause outrage. Second, the Israel lobby in the U.S. is trying to goad Congress into provoking Iran. House Resolution 362, which is being pushed by the American-Israel Political Action Committee, calls for a military blockade of Iran. Now, Iran would almost certainly view this as an act of war, as does international law. Yet were this the past, and if the Iranians retaliated, you can be sure that it would be spun by the government and the press as a first strike from the Iranians. Now, the resolution may not get passed, but that doesn't mean the situation is safe. Those who are hell-bent on war don't need a real provocation. An imaginary one will do just fine. Just recall the fabricated Gulf of Tonkin incident of 1964, which provided the excuse for the first large-scale U.S. military involvement in Vietnam. But as we've since learned, there was no second attack by the North Vietnamese in the Gulf of Tonkin. No renewed attacks against American destroyers. It was a false report, but by repeating government propaganda as though it were the truth, the corporate media helped pave the way for an unjustified war that took an incredible toll. It's doing it again. The bottom line is, the war profiteers and their front people in Washington would like nothing better than another opportunity to panic the public, spill its blood, and fill their wallets. With a lapdog corporate press and an American public that doesn't care to look behind the scenes, they might just get it. Hope to see you next week.
That old Beach Boys song, Bomberan. Bomb, bomb, bomb.
Bomb, 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 Iran. Bomb, 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 Iran.
That's Collateral News, episode 50. Would you believe it? Let's move quickly now to georgewashington.blogspot.com. This is big, my friends. I don't have a lot of 9/11 news for you this week, but confirmed, Pakistan general met with Joint Chiefs before 9/11. We've talked about this a lot. We've pretty much always had proof of it, but it's just the confirmation keeps coming and coming. In a response to a FOIA request submitted by Kevin Ryan, Mick Harrison, and Paul Smith, the government has disclosed documents, with a link for you to download them, the PDF, confirming that Pakistani ISI General Ahmed, you know, the guy who wired $100,000 to lead hijacker Mohammed Atta, met with senior representatives from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. CENTCOM Commander General Tommy Franks, the Director of Defense Intelligence Agency, Wolfowitz, Feith, and other PNAC members, and probably Intelligence Committee members Graham and Goss, Porter Goss, and others in the week before 9/11. You can, of course, see video of one journalist asking Condoleezza Rice about the ISI chief in Washington meeting with heads. And, of course, Condoleezza Rice said, he wouldn't meet with me. Next. If we jump again to thepeoplesvoice.org, there's a great article called "The Democrats Don't Care About You." Public service announcement. You don't need political analysts. Just read the news. Singular lines of news suffice at times. You are now in the post-analytic age. Here's a one-liner from a Yahoo News piece on the recent passage of the Snoops R Us bill in the Senate. Quote, Obama ended up voting for the final bill, as did Specter. That one sentence tells you all you need to know about where Obama and most Democrats stand. And there's a link for another article on Consortium News and more and more. Again, peoplesvoice.org. You can also, actually, let's hit that. Let's jump down to the last paragraph where they say, if you want real change, 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 and you think voting can bring some change, 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 then know this. The only difference you can make by voting is casting a protest vote. Tell the establishment they don't represent you in a written, documented form. Write in your name on the ballot. Better, write in your grandma's name. Stop handing blank checks to a government that is so plainly bent on screwing you. Stop being slaves. At least spit back in their face. Don't waste your vote. Don't waste the only political force you can legally exercise. Vote for Nader. Vote for Cynthia McKinney. For anybody but the establishment boys. And there's links there to read up on what Nader's up to. And, of course, Cynthia McKinney, the Green Party candidate, who's the only one who is a real, true friend of 9/11 truth. But if we jump to threat level up on Wired, 50%, that's half, of Sequoia voting machines in New York are flawed. New York State is in the process of replacing its lever voting machines with new voting equipment, but the state revealed recently that it has found problems with 50% of the roughly 1,500 image cast optical scan machines. And there's a little video, you can see how it works, that Sequoia Voting Systems has delivered to the state so far. Machines that are slated to be used by dozens of counties in the state's September 9th primary and November 4th presidential election. Just a little bit on the upcoming latest fraudulent election. See, in 2000, you know, it's always the Hegelian dialectic. Problem, reaction, solution. They create the problem to get the reaction out of you that they wanted so they can offer the thing they wanted in the first place. So we had this big election debacle, and everybody goes, oh, we need electronic and more faithful voting. And, well, be careful what you ask for, because we got it. We jump to Paul Joseph Watson. Mortgage giant's collapse could herald 30s-style depression. Veteran London Times journalist William Rees-Moogg, R-E-E-S-M-O-G-G, predicts that the collapse of the U.S. mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac could herald a downturn into a 1930s-style depression that threatens to sweep away democratic governments. Lest you think this is just some dude blowing hot air, Rees-Moogg served as the editor of the Times, Britain's oldest surviving newspaper, from 67 to 81, and currently sits in the House of Lords. In a column linked up for you on timesonline.co.uk, Rees-Moogg states that the world economy is not just entering an economic recession, but a depression comparable with the Great Crash of 1929 and its 10-year aftermath. Let's hit the ACLU and Raw replay and more and more. ACLU launches terror watch list complaint website.
As clutches of the watch list with little hope of escape. Now, as the legislative director at the ACLU, I'd be the first to admit that sometimes it's not a bad thing when members of Congress can't come back to vote. But when the great heroes of our time, like Nelson Mandela, end up on the watch list, then clearly the list has become an embarrassment and an impediment. Nelson Mandela was actually recently removed from the list. As Barry mentioned, through an act of Congress. It took an act of Congress to get off the watch list. But now Congress needs to act to make sure that all the Robert Johnsons, Gary Smiths, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of other innocents have their names removed. The government must scrap the current bloated watch list and institute a smaller, worst of the worst list made up of actual terrorists, or at the very least, terrorism suspects. This would help ensure that innocent, law-abiding Americans are no longer delayed and detained, and that the focus is once again on those who would do us harm.
I'm going to cut that one a little bit short because I got to keep moving forward. But there's an interesting dovetail with that one, along with the ACLU, is that a guy from CNN, Drew Griffin is his name, he found himself on the terror watch list after a report that he made where he dared to criticize the Transportation Security Administration.
Just crossing the half hour, the next time you find yourself at the airport ticket counter, you might be in for a surprise because you could be on the terror watch list. A new ACLU report says 1 million people are on it. One of them, Drew Griffin of CNN's Special Investigations Unit. And as he tells us now, while the threat posed by many of those on the list is imaginary, the hassle that they go through is all too real.
Washington attorney Jim Robinson is a former assistant attorney general. He's a former U.S. attorney from Michigan. He holds a high-level government security clearance, and he's a former law school dean, a husband, a granddad, an American. And he gets delayed, if not stopped, every time he gets on a plane. Why? Because Robinson is also one of the estimated 1 million names now on the terror watch list.
So it seems, for years now, despite my best efforts to get off.
This week, Robinson joined the ACLU in Washington to mark what the group calls a ridiculous milestone. 1 million names the government believes match known terrorists.
And again, I'm going to cut that one short. But we're now going to jump to the third part in the CNN TSA ACLU terror watch list with a little bit of satire. This is a great video that you have to watch. It's actually up on my MySpace profile, myspace.com/mediamonarchy. And it's something made, I believe, by the ACLU a couple years ago. However, it touches on so many important things.
Pizza Palace, guaranteed hot in 30 minutes or it's free. This is Mary. May I take your order?
Hi, Mary. Yes, I'd like to order.
Is this Mr. Kelly?
Yes.
Thank you for calling again, sir. I share your national identification number as 610-204-9998-45-54610. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. I see you live at 736 Montrose Court, but you're calling from your cell phone. Are you at home?
I'm just leaving work, but I'm...
Oh, we can deliver to Bob's Auto Supply. That's at 175 Lincoln Avenue, yes?
No, I'm on my way home. How do you know all this stuff?
We just got wired into the system, sir.
Oh, well... I'd like to order a couple of your double meat special pizzas.
Sure thing. There'll be a new $20 charge for this, sir.
What do you mean?
Sir, the system shows me that your medical records indicate that you have high blood pressure and extremely high cholesterol. Luckily, we have a new agreement with your national health care provider that allows us to sell you double meat pies as long as you agree to waive all future claims of liability.
What?
Do you agree, sir? You can sign the form when we deliver, but there is a charge for processing. The total is $67 even.
$67?
Well, that includes the delivery surcharge of $15 to cover the added risk to our driver of traveling through an orange zone.
I live in an orange zone?
Now you do. Looks like there was another robbery on Montrose yesterday. You could save $48 if you ordered our special Sprout Submarine Combo and picked it up yourself. Comes with tofu sticks. Those are very tasty, sir. Good value, too.
But I want double meat.
Well, I'm sure you can afford the $67, then. You just bought those tickets to Hawaii. They weren't cheap, eh? Oh, but I see you checked out the budget beach bum at the library last week. Up to you, sir.
All right. I'll get the Sprout sub.
Good choice, sir. Gotta watch that waist if you're hitting the beach, eh? 42 inches. Wow. Man, I'd say tofu and sprouts is, like, required.
That's how much?
Just between you and me, there's a $3 off coupon in this month's Total Men's Fitness magazine. Your wife, Betty, subscribes to that, right? Anyhow, clip that and it's $19.99 even. Whoa, looks like you maxed out on all your credit cards. Bring cash, okay?
That's a little satirical video, ACLU and the pizza order. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that they mention the national ID, and they also mention, of course, that your medical records will be tied into our new socialized health care, which our friends the Democrats are sure to bring in, and the new Freedom Initiative, and it'll require, of course, that you go to the doctor. And all those things will be taken into account, so if you want to get the double meat, it's going to cost you extra. Flying quickly now, on episode 84 of MediaMonarchy.com, it's just another stab wound, death by a thousand stab wounds, to our country. The latest Budweiser goes foreign. Mom and apple pie are next.
It's a $52 billion deal that could create the world's largest brewing company. Anheuser-Busch and Belgian brewery InBev reportedly have agreed to join forces, finally completing a merger that has been in the works for months. The deal still must be approved by shareholders and approved by regulators. Anheuser-Busch initially voted against the merger in June, saying InBev's $65 per share offer was too low. But the maker of Stella Artois and Beck then came back to the table, upping their offer to $70 per share to reach an agreement. Anheuser-Busch is by far the largest brewing company in the nation, owning more than 48% of the market share. InBev says it plans to use St. Louis as its North American headquarters and will keep all 12 of Anheuser-Busch's North American breweries open, but they did not say if there will be layoffs. It's not clear how long approval might take from regulators and shareholders. Anheuser-Busch InBev would be the new company's name if the final agreement is reached. Orla Reese, Associated Press.
It's a merger of some of the biggest brands in the business of beer. Budweiser, known the world over as the king of beers, is going to be made alongside Stella Artois and Beck's. U.S. brewer Anheuser-Busch, Bud's maker, has finally said yes to a sweetened $52 billion takeover bid from InBev, based in Belgium and the maker of Stella, Beck's, and a slew of other brands stocked at your local pub. The new company will be called Anheuser-Busch InBev. It'll be headed by InBev chief executive Carlos Brito.
Consumers have different needs, they look for different brands, different experiences, and this amazing portfolio that the combined company will have across all those different countries will enable consumers to stay within our franchise, even while looking for different experiences. So that's the beauty of this. It's about complementarity, not about overlap.
It's set to make more than a quarter of all beer drunk worldwide and generate annual net sales of more than $36 billion. Anheuser had spent a month saying no to InBev. Its battle to stay independent had become increasingly hostile. But all that hostility was set aside after the bid was improved last Friday.
We entered this negotiation. We had a range in mind, and we worked within that range, always using our financial discipline and value creation for our shareholders. But always also being mindful that our ultimate objective was to reach an agreed deal within our range in a friendly fashion. And that's where we met and agreed.
Next stop for the deal is with the regulators. If it goes ahead, it'll be the third largest ever foreign takeover of an American firm. Susan Flory, Reuters.
Just another example. It's a fire sale. Everything must go. Our highways, our roads, our businesses, our beer. We can't even make beer here anymore. Moving quickly, jumping to Danger Room up on Wired. Manchurian candidates to gather in Connecticut. For some, the horrors of the CIA's secret Cold War era mind control research has never really ended. Next month in Connecticut, self-described victims of MKUltra will attend the 11th annual Ritual Abuse, Secretive Organizations, and Mind Control Conference. There, attendees will discuss their memories of being unwitting participants in the CIA's experiments, which often involved slipping LSD to ordinary people. Are all the people who attend the meeting really victims of MKUltra? No, as the organizer himself notes. And that goes on, and it quotes Congressional Quarterly, and of course you can read about Richard Helms and more about MKUltra and MK Naomi and all that. If we jump now to vaccine death, cell tumors, food prices, and the value of life, TradingMarkets.com has farm giant kills 12 Argentine babies in vaccine trials. At least 12 babies who were part of a clinical study to test the effectiveness of a vaccine against pneumonia have died over the past year in Argentina, thanks to our good friends at GlaxoSmithKline. If we jump to naturalnews.com, frequent mobile phone use boosts tumor risk by 50%. Frequent users of cellular phones develop tumors of the parotid gland 50% more often than less frequent users. And it's linked up and you can read about it in the American Journal of Epidemiology. If we jump to Reuters, World Bank's Robert Zoellick says food prices are going to stay high until 2012. World Bank Pres Robert Zoellick said last Saturday he expected food prices to remain above 04 levels until at least 2012. If we jump to thinkprogress.org, EPA says the value of an American life has decreased. In May, the EPA lowered its value of a statistical life, measured to $6.9 million in today's dollars, which is a drop of nearly $1 million from just 5 years ago. In other words, in the eyes of the EPA, the value of a human life has decreased. And of course, we remember just a few months ago the article about, you know, in case of a national emergency, we're going to let sick and old people die. I've run out of time and I can't play the rest of... I had two more clips, and it's actually probably just as well, because this one... Bush aide caught offering access for donations. Basically, a London Times reporter, I believe, caught a Bush official on camera. Stephen Payne is his name. S-T-P-H-E-N-P-A-Y-N-E. Bush aide caught offering access for donations. The Times of London reports a lobbyist with close ties to the White House is offering access to six figures in George W. Bush's administration in return for six-figure donations to the private library being set up to commemorate Bush's presidency. Stephen Payne is a Bush pioneer and a political appointee to the Homeland Security Advisory Council. There are other updates and more to come, but again from Think Progress, DHS and House Oversight Committee open investigations into Payne's cash for access scandal. And there's a lot of links to MeTimes.com, and you can, of course, read about the Homeland Security Advisory Council up on DHS.gov. Now, there's funny stories of course, Bush saying, oh, yeah, maybe I remember that guy, but there's photos of them clearing brush in Crawford, Texas, together. If we jump to the great writer Larry Chin over at onlinejournal.com, and this is something we hit a little bit last week, FISA compromise, quote-unquote, completes the police state transformation. On Wednesday, that would be last Wednesday, the U.S. Congress overwhelmingly passed legislation permitting government spying, including giving immunity to telecom companies involved in secret domestic surveillance programs. With the stroke of W's pen, the U.S. is now... by definition, a police state. The extent of the spying program and its larger implications have, of course, been revealed by Mark Klein, who blew the whistle on the secret domestic spying program of Bush Cheney's NSA and AT&T. And you can, of course, hit up AT&T whistleblower. Spy bill creates infrastructure for police state. And there's more, and you can read about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and, of course, the bipartisan criminal consensus. If we hit up Blacklisted News again, and this is the other clip I won't be able to play, but the full video is up. It's under Dollar Doom, Fed Failure, and Bank Runs. Jim Rogers says that the dollar is doomed and that the Federal Reserve will fail. So in this very recent interview with Bloomberg, Jim Rogers says Asia is the future, the dollar is terribly flawed currency and he doesn't want to own any, oil will certainly pass $200 a barrel, and the privately owned Federal Reserve will disappear within the next decade. It's important that you check out that clip because he basically talks about he's left the United States, as of course, you know, Blackwater and Halliburton and Budweiser, they're all getting out. It's fire sale. Remember, Goodfellas, burning it down. If we head up Think Progress again, IndyMac seizure, second largest bank failure in U.S. history. If we hit MarketWatch, Chinese government is top foreign holder of Fannie and Freddie bonds. As politicians call for taxpayer bailouts and a government takeover of troubled mortgage lenders Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, FreedomWorks would like to point out that a bailout is a transfer of possibly hundreds of billions of U.S. tax dollars to sophisticated investors and governments overseas. The top five foreign holders of Freddie and Fannie long-term debt are China, Japan, the Cayman Islands, Luxembourg, and Belgium. In total, foreign investors hold over $1.3 trillion in these agency bonds, according to the U.S. Treasury's most recent, quote, report on foreign portfolio holdings of U.S. securities. And there's a link there. Run on banks spells big trouble for the U.S., this even coming out of Australia from the Sydney Morning Herald. In a modern financial system, nothing is more frightening than a run on the bank. The U.S. has now suffered a series of them, and they are escalating in size and scope, posing a serious threat to an already reeling economy. Humorously enough, reported by Press TV, Bush says he believes in a strong dollar, that at the recent meeting of Group of Eight Rich Nations. From FortBendNow.com, Ron Paul calls for hearings on falling dollar's impact. And finally, the AFP has U.S. economy loses jobs for the sixth straight month. The world's biggest economy lost jobs for a sixth straight month in June as U.S. employers shed 62,000 non-farm jobs amid a lingering slowdown. This all according to the Labor Department. If we now jump back to The Guardian, U.S. weapons research is raising a stink. The U.S. Army's XM-1063 projectile is designed to be non-lethal, but is it peaceful or hovering on the brink of illegality? And of course, it's the latter, and there's more that you can read about it, and it's brought to us another of our fine PMC private military contractor friends at General Dynamics. There's an very important report put out exclusively on blacklistednews.com by Dr. Doug Rocky. He is, of course, the former director of the U.S. Army's depleted uranium project. It was his task to clean up the radioactive battlefields of the Gulf War. Today, this leading opponent of nuclear warfare is vitally concerned that sand contaminated by radioactive munitions exploded in the Middle East has been shipped to Idaho for burial. And so the article is 6,700 tons of radioactive debris shipped from Kuwait to Idaho. And finally, quickly, my friends, weaving spiders come not here. The Bohemian Grove Club convened their annual meeting in California last Friday. Now, of course, you should watch Dark Secrets Inside Bohemian Grove, or just Google it, and you can read all about how our supposed Christian leaders run around naked in the woods and perform mock druid rituals. There's some whitewash stuff up from Sacramento News Review, but the PressDemocrat.com has some good stuff power brokers do at Bohemian Grove. There's a bizarre one from RenewAmerica.us. It's a fairly right-wing Christian site, and it talks a lot about prophecy, but interestingly enough, they're talking about some of the earthquake signs and that it basically looks like an earthquake could hit the Bohemian Grove while they're there, and would that, of course, be God's wrath and yada yada. But finally, from Paul Joseph Watson, Bush, McCain, and Obama to visit Bohemian Grove? Outgoing President George W. Bush and both his presumptive replacements, John McCain and Barack Obama, are rumored to be in attendance at this year's Bohemian Grove gathering, and that's nctimes.com. Bohemian Grove is, of course, an annual get-together of the global elite staged inside a sprawling forest encampment, which kicked off last Friday and runs until July 27th. And, of course, people like Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger, Alan Greenspan, David Rockefeller, Colin Powell, George W. Bush, and his father, and Newt Gingrich, and on and on and on, have all been to Bohemian Grove. That's going to do it, my friends. Episode 84, July 18th, 2008, MediaMonarchy.com. Let's hit some of the creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week. We had Level 3 Communications Googling HARP, West Virginia, July 2008. J.P. Morgan & Chase Googled Terror Watch List. Sony North America Googled Chicago Tribune DynCorp Child Kidnap. The Navy Network Information Center out of Jacksonville, Florida hit me up repeatedly. And they're reading about the JFK and 9/11 comparisons and contrastations. And they also hit me up from blacklistednews.com. Cold Spring Harbor, interestingly enough. You should look into Cold Spring Harbor. It kind of ties into MK Ultra. They Googled Jennings 9/11, of course, reading about Barry Jennings and Building 7. Biotechnology and Biological Science Research Group Googled, and this doesn't make any sense, ACPO retention guidelines for nominal records on the police national computer. American Express were reading about ACLU and their complaint site. Naval Command and Control and Ocean Surveillance Center Googled MHQ MOC. And that's about Operation Brimstone. The CBS Corporation hit me up for my YouTube channel. The AppGeaArmy.mil, they were reading about XM-1063, the big stinky U.S. weapon. Homeland Security was reading about Top All 5. We also had National Crime Prevention out of Arlington, Virginia, reading about Illinois Governor sending the National Guard to Chicago. Our old friends at the DEA. And then just this morning, somebody at Dartmouth College Googled Scenario, Nuclear Saudi Arabia. And finally, our good friends at Deutsche Bank, of course, connected to Buzzy Krongard and pre-9/11 insider trading in the CIA, Googled Deutsche Bank secret project. And so that's going to do it. And it's a scary place, my friends. And I thank you for taking the ride along with me. I'm going to be on the road for the next 2 weeks. I don't exactly know how Media Monarchy shows are going to come to you. I hope to take over my old FM radio station while I'm in Shepherdstown, WSHC 89.7. That remains to be seen. However, if I have to, I'll make podcasts sitting in the grass with a little microphone. One way or another, I'll be there for you. MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster. And like my man, Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.